From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. For many Americans, the holiday season began weeks ago with parties and shopping and the soundtrack of festive music. But for the men and women in the military and their families, the holidays can be a lonely and a difficult time. Brian Turner spent 7 years in the Army. He was deployed to Bosnia and to Iraq. And in his new volume of poetry, Here Bullet, he articulates some of the dislocation and some of the strange, quick moments of humor and even joy that being a soldier can bring. Brian Turner joins us now from the studios of Valley Public Radio in Fresno, California. Welcome, Brian.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for being with us. We're taking calls this hour as well at 877-962-9862. If you've been deployed during the holidays or have a loved one in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in the military somewhere around the world, how do you celebrate this season? Tell us what it's like for you if you have served and you've been overseas during the holidays. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. Brian, the holidays, not just Christmas, I guess, but all holidays are a time for families to gather. And I wonder what it is like. You tell me what it's like for soldiers deployed overseas.
For myself, I was thinking about this particularly Christmas that I spent over there. It was in 2004. And I remember we spent several hours that day out in these orchards in Balad, which is just north of Baghdad. And we were looking for, there was a report that there was a guy on a motorcycle going through the orchards with an RPG strapped to the back of his motorcycle. And we spent hours looking for this guy, and finally we found out that it was just a guy going out there stealing firewood from these orchards and strapping it on the back. But when we got back, there was a huge feast laid out for us, and it was a little bit cold, but it didn't matter. We were hungry. And the main thing I remember about the holidays is that sense of there is loneliness because you're far away, but you sort of share that loneliness with other soldiers.
Whenever I've been away, just away for the holidays, I find myself trying to push it out of my mind. I try to sort of avoid all of the trappings of the festivity because it just makes things worse. Do you find that soldiers do that, or it sounds like maybe they don't? You try to have a festive holiday anyway.
Well, it's hard. I think each person celebrates it their own way, or they don't. Maybe sometimes a lot of the year that I spent there, I did the opposite of what I did on holidays. That is, the rest of the year, I tried to sort of forget about home and not be too nostalgic and get sort of heartsick for home, you know, and just sort of do my job.
You're from Fresno. Did you grow up with a military family?
Absolutely. My grandfather was a Marine in World War II, fought against the Japanese, pretty much every major campaign in the Pacific Theater. And then my father was a Russian linguist during the Cold War, and it wasn't just a desk job. He really was flying over Russian airspace and listening in for radio traffic, things like that.
What made you decide to join the Army?
There's many factors, but a few of them were, it was a peacetime Army at the time and seemed like a good way to get cash to pay back for college. I did re-sign before the war broke out, and I guess I was newly married and also wanted to set up my family. And it was a really great way to instantly have everything we basically needed to survive and get started.
And you already had your MFA, Master of Fine Arts in Poetry, right, from the University of Oregon?
Absolutely. I'd gone to Fresno State prior to that and got a BA in English and then went up to University of Oregon.
It is not common. It's not that common, is it, for poets to join the Army?
Not to my knowledge. Usually someone will go to, like, for example, Yusuf Komunyaka might, someone, a poet like that, would go to war, come back, spend a few years going to college and talking and thinking about things, reflecting upon what had happened, and then write a book.
And now I've read that you considered yourself an embedded poet. What's that?
Well, in a lot of ways, I felt like my job was not, my first and primary job was to do my job as a soldier, but for myself and perhaps for others, I felt like my job was to be a witness to what was happening and to bring back what I could, a vision of that.
How did being a poet go over with your fellow soldiers?
Actually, most of them didn't know what I was writing. They knew I was a writer and that I'd been a teacher previously.
So you were a closet embedded poet is what you're saying.
Yeah, basically.
Did you feel that you had to keep this from them in a way?
A bit, because I was an NCO and I had to do my job. And there's a veneer to an NCO where you have to sometimes toe the line with soldiers, and you have to have sort of a tough demeanor sometimes. And I thought that might undercut that.
Would you read for us the title poem, Here Bullet?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Here, bullet, if a body is what you want, then here is bone and gristle and flesh. Here is the clavicle snapped wish, the aorta's opened valves, the leap thought makes at the synaptic gap. Here is the adrenaline rush you crave, that inexorable flight, that insane puncture into heat and blood. And I dare you to finish what you've started. Because here, bullet, here is where I complete the word you bring hissing through the air. Here is where I moan the barrel's cold esophagus, triggering my tongue's explosives for the rifling I have inside of me. Each twist of the round spun deeper. Because here, bullet, here is where the world ends every time.
Brian Turner reading the title poem from his latest volume, Here, Bullet. See, there's nothing untough about that poem. There's nothing nothing flowery about the speech.
Absolutely. I had written several manuscripts before from my time as a poet in Oregon onwards through Bosnia and now into Iraq. And previously I had written more musically and I guess you could say flowery with a lot more flourishes to the language. But I felt it wasn't honest to what I was witnessing there. I thought I had to have something that was stripped down, very bare narrative poetry.
What strikes me about this poem and much of your poetry is the way you create a relationship in places where I consider things more or less fractured. If you take a look at the line, here, bullet, here is where I complete your word, the word you bring hissing through the air, a sense of relationship between you and the bullet and the gun, which is counterintuitive in some ways. You hear a lot about people in war and stressful situations having disembodied experiences. It is precisely the disconnection between them and the environment that is the hallmark of stress and violence.
It's interesting. I felt sort of that things were melded a bit. That is, I was there and death was sort of hovering over all of us. And personally, for me personally, death, there was a chance that it was coming for me, so there's a sort of taunt in the poem towards death. But at the same time, my being there is helping create this entire situation. So that's why I tried to meld the barrel and the bullet and everything all together in that poem.
Did you have to separate the soldier from the poet in the course of your everyday activities?
Mostly, yes. Every now and then I might see something and a line would come to my head that I would just try to memorize real quick, but then I try to focus back on my job.
It seems, too, that what the poet does is sort of frame the experience and try to give voice to the ineffable. And maybe that's not the soldier's job. The soldier's job is to react to the very palpable. But I wonder to what extent the poetic vision, to poetic imagination, should be a requirement for a soldier. If a deeper understanding of what's involved, what's going on here, might not make a better soldier.
I think reflection, I can't see how it would hurt. It seems like wars or combat zones seem to magnify the quality of life. And life and death, the huge questions sort of come into play on a much bigger scale than like my average life here in Fresno, say.
There's a rich history of soldier poets in English and American literature. Did you have Wilfred Owens or Randall Jarrell in your head as you went over there?
I did have a little bit of Wilfred Owen, mostly Yusef Kumanyaka and Bruce Weigel. And also, it's not poetry, but I think it is on the verge of poetry, and that's Tim O'Brien, who's a fiction writer.
And you're a fan of Gilgamesh, so you were in the right place when you got to Iraq.
Absolutely, walking right where the tablets were discovered. I remember walking it snowed in Mosul. I didn't even know it snowed up there. We had moved up towards Mosul for a while, and we were out in the Nineveh ruins, and it was maybe 3 in the morning. We had our MVGs on, and we were walking in formation. I remember turning around to, you know, check positions where everyone was at, and I just remember, also, there was a moment, like you'd mentioned before, where poetry sort of snuck in, and I just had a brief moment where I realized, you know, I'm in the snow flats, it's dark, and there were soldiers here. And this is where Gilgamesh, the Sumerians, and all the different cultures have brought this epic poem through the ages back to us.
And it's an epic poem that deals with all the big questions, certainly.
Absolutely. Love and friendship, yes.
Yeah, fear of death, certainly.
And yeah.
In heroic ways, are we, and in those cultures, especially in ancient cultures, folks were steeped in the myth. The myth was a kind of a living thing, a living organism, part of the culture. Have we abstracted art and literature from our daily living to the point that we sort of have very different understandings about our own experience and about even as Americans? Forget the cultural differences between us and, say, the Iraqis.
I'm not sure. I don't know how deeply embedded antiquity is felt or realized in our culture, but it seems like film and music, as far as art goes, is oftentimes something we lean like a crutch on when times are bad or difficult.
I want to get back to this idea of home, too, and being away from the holidays. And I wonder if the idea of home is something that is haunting or comforting for soldiers when you're in the field.
I used to dream about home sometimes. I tried not to think about it during the day, but I'd wake up having dreamed about floating over my family's property, things like that. Very vivid dreams of home. So it definitely resonated there.
Did you ever have a sense that you wanted to share your poetry as you were writing it with at least a few of the guys, somebody or young men or women over there who might understand or might reflect on your poetry?
I did, but I mostly had, there was access to the internet. So when we were on the post or one of the FOBs or forward operating bases, and if we had a chance to actually get on the internet, I'd contact people back home and sort of share my work that way. But with the people there who were experiencing the same things, I didn't want to share it till I got back, and then I wanted to see what they thought about it.
We'll talk more about that with Brian Turner, a former soldier and poet. His book here, Bullet, chronicles his time in Iraq. Later in the program, we're going to consider alternatives to holiday gifts. So if you have a favorite charity or a way to spread the spirit of the season that's not about shopping, you can call us at 877-962-9862. For the rest of the program, you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Soldier and poet Brian Turner is with us today. His new book is called Hear Bullet, and we're taking your calls about how the holidays affect military families. Our number is 877-962-9862. Brian, just before the break, you talked about saving your poetry for other soldiers till you got back. What kind of reactions have you gotten?
Well, I talked with a soldier. He had joined initially so that he could go to film school. He wanted to make enough money to go to film school. And so we connected in a lot of ways with art. And when I got back, I wanted to especially get his opinion on, for example, there was a soldier who had killed himself in our unit, and a couple other poems that I'd written. So it seemed like they resonated well with him, and he thought that they were working as well. So that made me feel more confident.
A little more confident. Read for us, would you, another poem, Baghdad Zoo, if you would.
Absolutely, sure. An Iraqi northern brown bear mauled a man on a street corner, dragging him down an alley as shocked onlookers shouted and threw stones. There were tanks rolling their heavy tracks past the museum and up to the Ministry of Oil. One gunner watched a lion chase down a horse. Eaten down to their skeletons, the giraffes looked prehistoric, unreal, their necks too fragile, too graceful for the 21st century. Dalmatian pelicans and marbled teals flew over, frightened by the rotor wash of Black Hawk helicopters touching down. One baboon escaped the city limits. It was found wandering in the desert, confused by the wind, the blowing sands of the Barshan Dunes.
Brian Turner, from his volume of poetry, Hear Bullet. At one point you quote in the book, you quote Ernest Hemingway. The quote is, "This is a strange new kind of war where you learn just as much as you're able to believe." It strikes me that being in a war zone, and after hearing that poem, Baghdad Zoo, the imagery must be so, and I assume this happened because this was a real event. The zoo must have busted loose and the animals escaped. I mean,
right. That was an initial invasion.
Yeah.
My unit wasn't there for that part, but when I was there, I found out about this information, and it fascinated me. So that poem came from that. But it spoke to me for that exact same reason of the bizarre quality and the surreal things that happen at times.
How do soldiers put all this together, imagery that they would never have imagined, could never have imagined, now being forced to somehow make real?
I think that's why poetry was the right vehicle for me for this particular thing, because I've seen a lot of war movies and read a lot of books on war, and oftentimes they're written in a larger narrative, and that didn't seem to work for me because I couldn't put together the pieces. So each thing seemed an intense moment of its own, and so lyric poetry or narrative poetry on a smaller scale seemed to fit that better. Mm. And then trying to find an overarching narrative was still very difficult for me to put the book together in that kind of sense.
Well, there's a poem, another one actually, that I would like you to read that also I think is a pretty good example of this, Two Stories Down. It's on page 17 if you have it there. Talking to Brian Turner, a soldier who spent 7 years in the military, including stays in Iraq and Bosnia, and has published a volume of poetry called Hear Bullet, and is about to read a poem from that volume called Two Stories Down.
Two Stories Down. When he jumped from the balcony, Hassan swam in the air over the Asher Street Market, arms and legs suspended in a blur above palm hearts and crates of lemons, not realizing just how hard life fights sometimes, how an American soldier would run to his aid there on the sidewalk, trying to make sense of Hassan's broken legs, his screaming, trying to comfort him with words in an awkward music of stress and care. A soldier he'd startled by stealing the knife from its sheath, the two of them struggling for the blade until the blood groove sunk deep, and Hassan whispered to him, "Shukran, Sadiq, shukran. Thank you, friend. Thank you."
Two Stories Down. Brian, you know, I was talking with my producer about this poem. I was really struck by the imagery, and what is interesting is that the two of us had a very different idea about the narrative, about what was happening in this poem. I saw an insurgent running away and killing an American soldier who was trying to help somebody and who was obviously in pain, and the soldier didn't bother to ask friend or foe first. She saw an attempted suicide and someone who actually, you know, was about to commit suicide by cop, as they say, trigger the soldier's response and finish the job that he had started by jumping out the window. First of all, I want to ask about the narrative. Did you see something like this happen?
This was something happened in my battalion, and the word came around about what had happened, and so we all sort of talked about the same thing. We were intrigued by it as well.
So settle a bet.
Well, I'm speaking with you, and we're having a very friendly conversation, so I don't want to go against you, but she's correct.
She's right. Yeah, no, it did make more sense. But it's this, we can talk, too, about, first of all, the wonderful ambiguity, which gives me a break. You see, I cut myself a break by talking about the ambiguity of this poem. But in the narrative, the idea that it is so confused, the idea of who is the friend, who is the enemy, what we are thankful for, and what is the mission?
Yes, all very good questions. And I did try to make the narrative confusing on that because the mission is confusing at times. The mission boiled down for us, because I had soldiers who worked under me, not many. I was a team leader. But what was I supposed to tell them why they're there, to keep them motivated and keep their morale up? And the best thing that I could come up with, and I think this is true through many wars, is that we were there for the soldier to the left and the right of us. Hmm. And that my job was to make sure that I brought back my guys both physically sound and mentally sound, and bring them back home. And do whatever we had to do when we were there and then come home.
That suggests that perhaps you wouldn't want politics to intrude on that model, that you might need to not think too deeply about the politics if that was
your couldn't. Mission. Yeah, I couldn't personally, because I felt if I interjected my politics, it would undermine the morale of the soldiers working for me.
So then what do you tell yourself if you have this other narrative running through your head?
That I had to do the same thing, that my job was to make sure that I concentrated, to make sure that those guys came home safe and sound, and myself as well, and that I watched and paid attention to what happened while we were there so that I could write about it. And then there's a writer, I wish I knew who said this, but they said that a writer's job is not to write the answers that solve the problem, but to write the questions better.
Do the politics of this war, do you think, affect other soldiers? Do they have to, do they find themselves pushing the politics away or embracing a politics more vigorously in order to fight?
I really can't speak for other soldiers, but if I were to guess, I would say that sometimes we, I really don't know. I really can't speak for others. I guess I shouldn't do that.
Well, what about and getting back to this ambiguity of mission, finding yourself in situations where you don't know if you're assisting a suicide or helping an enemy or what you're doing, does this confusion at all make it more difficult for soldiers to sort of wake up the next day and carry out the mission?
Yes, because with this type of war where there isn't a front line and you know the enemy is there, you're walking through the streets patrolling, and you might see someone waving to you now, and then tomorrow they might be trying to shoot at you.
Were you worried?
Very,
yeah. I wonder if you were worried at any point, if indeed the writer's job is to ask the question in a better way, if you began asking questions so well that you couldn't serve anymore.
On the verge of leaving, I was still talking to my parents. My mom wanted to buy me a plane ticket to Australia. We have family there. But I decided in the end that I had put my hand up and made an oath that I would carry it out.
Read for us another poem, will you? What every soldier should know.
Can I preface that with a quick note?
Sure.
Before we left, we had briefings. Those of us had security clearances. There were different types of briefings, and a lot of soldiers know this. But they had an Iraqi gentleman come out and give us some information about what we should know before we went there. So some of that is embedded in this poem, and then the rest is things that we learned while we were there. It's prefaced with a quote by Rousseau, which says, "To yield to force is an act of necessity, not of will. It is at best an act of prudence." What every soldier should know. If you hear gunfire on a Thursday afternoon, it could be for a wedding or it could be for you. Always enter a home with your right foot. The left is for cemeteries and unclean places. Oguf tara armik is rarely useful. It means stop or I'll shoot. Sabah al-khair is effective. It means good morning. Inshallah means Allah be willing. Listen well when it is spoken. You will hear the RPG coming for you, not so the roadside bomb. There are bombs under the overpasses, in trash piles, in bricks, in cars. There are shopping carts with clothes soaked in foo gas, a sticky gel of homemade napalm. There are parachute bombs and artillery shells sewn into the carcasses of dead farm animals. A graffiti is sprayed under the overpasses. "I will kill you, American." Men wear vests rigged with explosives to walk up, raise their arms, and say, "Inshallah." There are men who earn $80 to attack you, $5,000 to kill. There are small children who will play with you, old men with their talk, women who offer chai. And the people who wave and smile today, remember, they may dance over your body tomorrow.
What Every Soldier Should Know, a poem included in Hear Bullet, a volume of poems by Brian Turner, a soldier and a poet who is in Fresno, California right now and speaking with us. You know, I've heard this poem, I've read it several times, and now I hear it, and it strikes me that this is all good advice, and in many ways, I don't know how I would use it all.
I'm not sure if we were able to use it all either.
Does it?
Because sometimes you have to say stop or I'll shoot, you know.
So. Yeah, or small children who will play with you, old men who will talk. There are men who earn $80 to attack you, $5,000 to kill. It's valuable information, but how do I discern? How do I know who is who?
And how do soldiers do that too? I remember sitting. We had an observation post in the city of Mosul. We had taken over an abandoned house, and it was really hot. It was summer, of course, and some children came across this open lot. And their mother had cut fruit for us and carved it up on this big platter and they handed it over to the wall, over the wall to us, and we ate this fruit, and it was delicious. It was really a nice, kind gesture. But at the same time, in another one nearby, a different observation post, when my squad went off shift from that observation post, then the next squad that was there, some of the kids that we play with the kids oftentimes, and one of those kids threw a grenade in the room. So you just don't, like you said, who's friend or foe? When did they become foe? When did they become friend?
Yeah, and when do soldiers, in a sense, begin to ignore advice because, you know, it may come from someone's experience, but there's no way to apply this in the next situation, on the next watch.
And how do you stay vigilant 24 hours a day for us, 366 days? We had a leap year, so we had an extra day.
I hope extra day's pay for that.
No,
it doesn't work that way. Well, the other thing the poem suggests too are the profound cultural differences and the importance of understanding those differences. How deep are the differences, and how problematic are they? How difficult is it for Americans to understand a Near Eastern mind?
I wish I could answer that, but the best that I can answer it is that when I looked around, what I saw predominantly were men and women and children who wanted to go to school, who wanted to, you know, fall in love, have friends. They want to do everything that we want to do here. You know, you're driving down the road and a police car pulls up behind you, and you might be completely legal, all your stuff, you're good, but you still just don't want a cop behind you. Well, you really don't want a, you know, a striker vehicle pulling up behind you either. So it's, I can understand their plight.
Were you ever upended by an expectation that just thoroughly threw you? In other words, everything's going along. Here's somebody who wants the best for their child. They want to send them to school. And then they do or say something that would be completely contrary to what an American would expect.
Actually, yes, in the sense that I remember we were on a rooftop, one of those observation posts, and two kids came up and started playing with us up there. And when I was a kid, I don't think I would do that. It just didn't seem like smart. But they got so used to having soldiers walking in the streets and in the area, and they were curious to know what we're like, that the fear was taken out of it. Their father ended up coming and talking with me and asking us if we could maybe move to a different building. And we actually ended up doing that. So we found an abandoned building nearby.
Given the concern for you know, who might be friend and foe, and even the fact that children might be now employed in this, how did you react to that? Were you afraid?
I think it's hard not to be.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'd be lying if I didn't say I found it interesting and fascinating. And I was one part of me was really glad to be there, just to be a sort of a part of what was happening. While at the same time, the politics of it, I couldn't get my head around it.
Would you read another one for us? How about A Soldier's Arabic?
Sure. That's the one with the Hemingway quote, which says, again, this is a strange new kind of war where you learn just as much as you're able to believe. A Soldier's Arabic. The word for love, Habib, is written from right to left, starting where we would end it and ending where we might begin. Where we would end a war, another might take as a beginning or as an echo of history recited again. Speak the word for death, Mott, and you will hear the cursives of the wind driven into the veil of the unknown. This is a language made of blood. It is made of sand and time. To be spoken, it must be earned.
We think of war as utterly destructive and damaging to all parties, even the survivors in some way. One of the things this poem suggests is that there will be people coming back from that theater who will actually understand better that part of the world, have a better understanding of the people over there.
Absolutely, I hope so. There's a rich culture there with a lot of, this touches on the last question you had as well, and there's much that we can learn just as they can learn from us. And if we're going to be there, part of that means that all these soldiers coming back, myself included, but there are hundreds of thousands of soldiers coming back with families and lovers and friends and mothers and fathers, and it's going to permeate our culture. So it'll become part of our national consciousness. It'll change what it means to be an American. It'll add to it.
You do this intentionally. You're a poet. You have to distill this thought and then express what you felt there. Soldiers who have been in traumatic situations, that may not be the best thing, the wisest thing, and certainly not the thing a soldier would want to do, is to relive these experiences. Will they bring this understanding back, do you think, in any appreciable numbers?
I worry about PTSD and the inability to get out or to sort of wrangle with the issues that need to be wrangled with. As far as on the positive side, I think some of those things will come out, but because it is such a difficult thing to be deployed away for so long, and it's hard on, you know, both at home and the person who's deployed, I think a lot of times people just sort of shut that out and try to move on and get to the things that they wanted to do originally.
Do you think it would be useful for the military to set up some kind of program? Not everybody's cut out to be a poet, but some way to take a look back and reflect on this experience and in some way creatively express or understand what's happened.
I'm sure that there are programs. I realize when we came back, we had some briefings that tried to get some to screen people for PTSD. I don't know if I can pitch another website or anything here.
Sure.
There are some organizations. There's an organization called Voices in Wartime, and it's on the web. It's one word. And voicesinwartime.org. At that place, they have a pilot project where they're trying to get therapists wedded with poets, and they have a thing called expressive writing projects where they'll get returning vets with PTSD and try and get them all together and use writing as a vehicle to get towards those issues that they need to wrestle with.
So, Brian, what is your next project? Will you stick with this theme? Do you feel the need to move on?
I do want to experience more things and move on to other things. I may revisit this in the future. There is one idea that's sort of lagging with me, and I can't seem to get rid of it. So I might need to deal with that. But
an idea from Iraq.
Yes. And that may turn into a book. But first, I'd like to travel a bit. So this year, I'm here intentionally to be with my family for about a year, so I can sort of reacquaint myself with my family. But then I do want to travel some more.
Brian Turner, safe travels, and thank you for being with us.
Can I pitch one last thing?
Sure.
Booksforsoldiers.com. It's a great way to give a gift at Christmas time.
All right. Thank you very much. Brian Turner, former soldier with the U.S. Army and author of Hear Bullet, a collection of poems. And if you're looking for other gift ideas, stay right here. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. If you don't need one more electric sandwich squasher, then you should listen to this next segment of the program where we will take a look at other alternative buying solutions. Charitable giving at this time of year, 877-962-9862. The State of Things continues. Stay with us.